And you are tuned into CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. It's just after 8:10. Today here in Montreal, we're going to be having a discussion on India and Operation Green Hunt, a major military campaign that has been declared by the Indian government and Prime Minister Manmohan Singh in the eastern provinces in opposition to Maoist guerrillas who are living in tribal communities. There's a major debate happening across India on Operation Green Hunt, but very little discussion here in North America or in the Canadian media about what is happening today in India. We'll be examining another side to India's economic miracle, as it's often discussed. We'll be joined by Dolores Chu from the South Asia Center here in Montreal and Firuz Mehdi from Alternatives International. So do stay tuned. We'll be having a live in-studio discussion about Operation Green Hunt in contemporary India. That will be broadcasting until 9 a.m. This is the Tuesday morning after on CKUT 90.3 FM. We're broadcasting here in Montreal and also globally at www.ckut.ca. Before we launch into the discussion, we're going to be hearing from Asian Dub Foundation, and this is Color Line.
Today, the color line is the power line, is the poverty line. line is the power line, is the poverty line.
CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, and it's just about 8:20, and you're tuned into the Tuesday Morning After, broadcasting here on CKUT. We're joined in studio for a discussion on Operation Green Hunt in India with Dolores Chu from the South Asia Center and Firoz Mehdi from Alternatives International. Before we launch into the discussion with our in-studio guests, I just want to give a couple of points of background information about Operation Green Hunt. It's an issue that is a major discussion right now in South Asia, but something that has garnered very little media attention here in North America, but an issue that is incredibly important in regards to the political situation and also the economic development of one of the world's largest economies. Well, basically, there is a battle taking place between the government of India and what is known as the Naxalites, the Maoist forces in the eastern provinces. Recently, in the Indian capital, there was a people's tribunal about Operation Green Hunt. The summary of that tribunal basically said that the development model, which has been adopted and which is sharply embodied in the new economic policies of liberalization, privatization, and globalization, have led in recent years to a huge drive by the state to transfer resources, particularly land and forests, which are critical for the livelihood and survival of the tribal people, to corporations for exploitation of mineral resources. And that's really, I think, maybe from what I'm gathering and reading, one of the key issues around Operation Green Hunt is resources and land. So just to go into the discussion, we'll start with Dolores, and thank you also for coming today, coming directly into studio. It's an issue that we're not hearing a lot about, Operation Green Hunt, but maybe talk about some of the key points around land and resources in relation to this, what is being called a military campaign by the Indian government, Operation Green Hunt. How do land and resources in relation to India's economy fit into this Operation Green Hunt that we're discussing today?
Well, framing it in that sort of neoliberal context, I would say that, you know, many Indians in India and in the diaspora are really proud today because, you know, India's up there. You hear a lot about it. You know, the GDP is very high. You know, Indian billionaires number the same number as the German billionaires, and companies like Tata, etc., are just global now. But being global means also staying competitive, and staying competitive means getting your hands on resources that you can get very cheaply. So there's intensive pressure now on natural resources in India, and the last bastion are the lands where indigenous people live. And India in that way is not unlike other parts of the world where indigenous people are living on lands that are rich in natural resources, and getting them off the land is part of the neoliberal agenda, whether it is in Latin America or in Canada or in India for that matter.
So to Firoz Mehdi from Alternatives International, in the indigenous areas, the tribal communities in the eastern states, the leftist forces have had a long history. So maybe if you could provide us with some context for people who aren't maybe aware of some of that history.
Yeah, I mean, in these places where we now hear about that Maoists are supporting the indigenous people in getting back their land or not getting pushed out from their land, it's nothing new. It's been going on since I would say 1950s even, mostly the struggle has been not only to protect the land and the resources for the people, but also to build some kind of a left movement, which in their own plans wishes to take over state power at some point. Mm-hmm. So it's from local to the whole national vision, mm-hmm. which these movements have. How successful they have been and what were the failures, That is also a part of a lot of study being done done in India. And this has resurfaced again after three or four factions of the Naxalites. They united a few years ago, who were working in different areas. Some were working in the southern Indian provinces, others were in the north Indian provinces, and this whole forest belt, which connects them, that this unity gave them some more, if you want, gun power and some more presence and visibility.
And the discussion today in India about Operation Green Hunt and the debate about how to access these resources. Feroz, you talked about the forest belt, but Dolores, from your reading of the discussion today in India on the issues we're talking about.
Well, I think to pick up from what Feroz said, you know, these movements are not new. What has brought them into the spotlight is that kind of pressing need for resources. In the past, the slogan was land to the tiller, and a lot of organizing was happening among the indigenous tribal groups, but also among poor peasants. For example, the state of Bihar was once considered, parts of it were central to this kind of Naxalite or Maoist struggle. We don't hear about Bihar now. The focus has shifted to the indigenous areas, and that's where the sort of neoliberal agendas and the resources become primary. And it's sort of this impatience of the Indian elites and the ruling class and big corporate interests, like telling the government, like, what are you doing? Why are you sitting on your butts? Do something about these people that is making it so pressing, making it so urgent. And so it's this time in history that is bringing this focus to, you know, the so-called Operation Green Hunt, which is really a term that the Indian media has created. Like, the government doesn't use this term, and the groups involved on the ground don't use this term. And, you know, talking about the media also, again, the Indian media, the mainstream Indian media, is very much tied in with these corporate interests. It's really an embarrassment to watch Indian TV now, where you don't get anything. It's just sensationalism and sort of, okay, they've just arrested, you know, they've dragnetted this area and they've arrested this Maoist leader. And it's just a feeding frenzy without real analysis. And it's also happening in a period in Indian history where we have gone, you know, half a century beyond Indian independence. And so, say, people of my generation who were raised with some semblance of serving the people, now it's about, you know, going to shopping centers and just being the same, if you can afford it, as somebody in New York or London. So that sort of empathy, even if it might have been somewhat problematic with the common person, is no longer there. There's a kind of impatience and a dismissal, and, like, nobody wants to hear this story anymore.
And to add to what Dolores was is saying, this impatience on the part of the middle classes or the rich urban classes, that gives rise to the need or desire for security. Like, they have to protect their enclaves. You see it very, very clearly in cities like Delhi, or if you walk around, I mean, this encroachment of public spaces, the privatization of public roads, putting gates and barricades and kind of checkpoints on in colonies where rich people live. So, I mean, this call for arms against any disruptions will come from this class, that they have now so much, they are living in a portion of poverty around them, and they have to protect their own rich habits and their properties. So anything which they feel threatened, they will be very happy to call in the police or army or whatever.
Well, certainly there is a focus on what was called for many years India Shining, and this new face of India of economic success and middle class. It's the subject of many lengthy magazine articles and features and papers like the New York Times, for sure. In regards to poverty, it's also a reality that increasingly is on the global stage, and was glamorized almost in the film Slumdog Millionaire, the ocean of poverty that you talked about. When you were both commenting, I was, before preparing for the segment, reading an article by Arundhati Roy for The Guardian, and she was writing under the title The Heart of India is Under Attack, and she wrote, in our smoky, crowded cities, some people say, so what? Someone has to pay the price of progress. Some even say, let's face it, these are people whose time has come. Look at any developed country, Europe, the US, Australia, they all have a past. Indeed they do. So why shouldn't we? So that quote I found interesting because it ties into kind of a critical analysis of history around development, whether it's in North America in relation to indigenous people, and it, of course, until today. So maybe just I'll throw out another point. What is the reality for people outside of India's cities and these major metropolises that we hear so much about, and specifically around the tribal communities? What are they fighting for?
I think you'll even get it from the parliament figures. Around 70% of Indians are living on 20 rupees and less. So if that is shining India, then I don't know what kind of a shine is that. It's the contrast between the rich, as Dolores said, there's so many millionaires and billionaires in India. If that is the news which gets out in the media, then that's not even half of the story. We are talking, as I said, about 70% of the population earning rupees 20 and less a day. Now, these things have to be addressed. And through the pressures from I would say, local politics and some social movements, there are some things happening. Uh-huh. For example, the Rural Employment Guarantee Act, which was passed a few years ago, which guarantees a certain number of days of employment every year to agricultural labor. Okay. Or, for example, just a week ago, this compulsory education bill, which says that from 6 years to 14 years, by law, children have to go to school. Now, this will put some pressure on the exchequer, on the budgets, and things might happen in some ways. Now, these are all it's a very complex situation. The multinationals and the industries are in a rush to take over the natural resources because they need that wealth. Uh-huh. And at the same time, the compulsions of parliamentary politics is that they have to address these problems. Uh-huh. Of education, of unemployment, of health. What is the balance? That is what gets into the way. Like the rush, there's a big rush to, with the military, with the police, to get hold of resources, natural resources and land, and privatization. At the same time, they have to look at their own electoral base, and also the pressures from the social groups, social movements there, which are demanding that more than half a century after independence, the education level are so low.
Dolores?
I just want to go back to that quote that, you know, Manmohan Singh used. Everybody quotes where the Indian state says the single largest internal security threat to the country are the Maoists. And you can just sort of turn that on its head and say, you know, why are the Maoists the single largest internal security threat to the country? Or are they really the single largest internal security threat to the country? If, you know, people have a decent standard of living and their basic necessities are met, they will not be dissatisfied. And so we find that not just in India, but in many states, it's when the oppressed raise their voices that they are seen to be threatening the status quo and the established order. As long as they die quietly, they're not seen as threats. But the minute they challenge this, it's a problem. So we go back to this question of development and what is development. And recently, the Home Minister of India said, said, you know, the government has to adopt a multi-pronged approach to this threat, the Maoist threat. And he said, you know, they, of course, they will, you know, unfurl the might of the state against the threat, but there also has to be development and there has to be dialogue. But, you know, going back to what Feroz was saying, I mean, more than half a century after the independence of India, what kind of development has there been for the poor, the marginalized, the people in rural areas? We have an amazing, you know, constitution, one of the best in the world, you know, legal systems, but accessing that right from the level of the village and, you know, the injustice of the local police and the police station right up. And what we're seeing right now is also a lot of the people who, from the middle classes, who have taken up these causes. They might not be linked to any Maoist movement, but they are being arrested, they are being detained because they are seen as threats, because they are the ones who are able to bring some of these voices to the fore. So the Indian state sees this as a threat to its own chosen path of development. And I should say it doesn't even stop with the Indian state. Our local CSIS are very interested in knowing, you know, in the diaspora, what is going on with these Indian Maoists. Is there support for them? So the Indian state has been very successful in getting that message out that the state is threatened by the Maoists. But we need to ask the question, why are the Maoists even able to get a base, you know, irrespective of whether you agree with that ideology or not? Why? And, you know, to go back to the great national, internationally known nationalist leader, Gandhi, I mean, he himself said poverty is the worst form of violence. So, you know, going back to the sort of Gandhian tradition also, we can see that there are huge problems here.
And then the silent crisis, as Dolores mentioned, it's about thousands of suicide deaths by farmers in India. I mean, why isn't that a threat to Indian democracy?
Explain a bit more. I mean, just for listeners, the fact that so many Indian farmers under the economic reality today in India have been committing suicide.
Yeah, the indebted farmers in India who are very down in debt. Like the government subsidies which exist even in the United States for the farmers, right? Uh-huh. Why aren't such subsidies available for Indian farmers in case of drought, in case of cheaper grains being dumped into the economy so their crops gets completely destroyed, they can't sell them? And there's small columns coming in one or two newspapers, but if you start counting them, they're going to hundreds and thousands of suicides, farmer suicides in India. And I mean, this is this I think is not even getting that much attention as Operation Green Hunt and all the announcements and the media pronouncements of how dangerous it is and it should be stopped, and the whole, I don't know, this whole hype around this is so much that this is the only thing threatening India these days.
It seems that behind the headlines of Operation Green Hunt, or if we're looking at the reality of peasants in India, one of the key issues is extreme inequality.
Yes.
So in regards to that, I mean, I'm reading again from Arundhati Roy's article in The Guardian, and she says, according to the Naxalites or the Maoists, believe that the innate structural inequality of Indian society can only be redressed by the violent overthrow of the Indian state. And she goes back to kind of explain a bit of history, which is, I think, interesting for listeners. The article, again, is called The Heart of India is Under Attack. But this extreme inequality, I think that some would argue that a successful way to address extreme inequality is massive and quick economic growth. And through that, there is this idea that economic growth will trickle down, and that through that, the non-urban areas and the peasants will access that extreme wealth that can be mobilized through India's projection into a major economic superpower in the world. I mean, I kind of let's say, it seems to be one of the key points of the ideology around India shining, but a critical view on that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's the classic Western industrialization model. And yeah. So when Britain and Western Europe industrialized, they had colonies overseas. When the United States industrialized, they just committed genocide on indigenous people and took over the sort of terra nullis, the land where nobody lived. You know, India has a population of over a billion. So where is it going to expand, and where is that, where are those costs going to, and whose shoulders? So it's going to lie on the poorest people in India, whose voices do not get, you know, beyond the forest levels or beyond the village levels. So if one accepts this sort of inevitability of history, that, you know, to get out of poverty you have to industrialize, and there's only one model, and that's the model that the West went through, the Industrial Revolution, then of course, yes, somebody has to bear the brunt, and, you know, it's not going to be the upper classes, and in a couple of generations down the road, the wealth will trickle down. But we know, again, from the Western industrial model, that this does not happen. The wealth does not trickle down. And one of the fallouts at the end of the fall of the Berlin Wall and, you know, the end of two superpowers is that you basically have the triumph of neoliberal capitalism, and there's nothing there to stop or put the brakes on, you know. And so both India and China that have been, you know, presented as these exemplars of, you know, incredible development and growth, are both in deep trouble. I mean, in the last Chinese Congress, the president has said we've got to look to the rural areas, because this, even if you aren't altruistic, it's going to bring the House of Cards down. So whether you're looking at it from an empathetic point of view, or you're looking at it from a purely pragmatic point of view, you have to look to the poor and dispossessed, because even if they're not able to mobilize completely, it is going to cause disaster.
Yeah, I mean, there have to be some alternate ways of development. You cannot follow the same industrialization model for sure. That's my point of view. What kind of alternative development models? It cannot be invented in a day. You can't write a thesis. Anybody cannot come up with a model and say, okay, let's do it this way. It's trials. Wow. It's give space to people to try new methods. We have seen some things happening in Brazil. We have seen certain things happening in the certain Indian province of Kerala. Some kind of a participatory development models. It's not an overnight thing. Uh-huh. It takes time, but the earlier model of these people have to be erased or killed, because their time is over, and this is how development has worked in the past, and this is how it should work. I have doubts. I don't think people will allow that, and I think there will be resistance to that. And given the end of this bipolar world, and given the fall of the Berlin Wall, I think some other models have to be explored, and I think they are being explored in certain ways. Yes. And this impatience on the part of neoliberal model, that has to be brought to an end.
Uh-huh. And do you believe in India that's this neoliberal model is bringing the country into a critical direction?
Yes, it is. It is.
Why?
For sure. I mean, it is increasing the gap between those who are making lots of wealth and those who remain marginalized. And this is one of the probably symptoms of that is this Maoist movement. And one of the symptoms of that is also decentralization of Indian parliamentary system is also, I think, one of the reactions or one of the symptoms of too much centralized control over economy. So now in India, you see since a couple of decades, there has been no single party in power in the parliament. It is the provinces who add up to make the federal government. So these are all the, I think, conflicts and dynamics which exist. They are not just because people wanted it that way. There are some reasons, some compulsions why this decentralization of Indian parliamentary politics is a reaction to something. Uh-huh. Is a reaction which I think has emerged from the local needs of provinces. Uh-huh. How it will manifest later, how will it develop, I do not know. But for sure, the neoliberal model is for sure not working, and it's creating more tensions in Indian society rather than resolving anything.
Dolores, anything on this point?
I think in fact what should be done is to sort of see this period in Indian history as a period of opportunity, rather than saying let's stamp out the resistance. Let's understand why the resistance is there and deal with it, because it's not going to go away. It's going to get bloodier and more brutal, but it won't go away. I mean, it might subside because people get weary, but it will come up again. And the fact that the current leadership of the armed struggle, the Maoists, I mean, go back to say Naxalbari and the people involved. The Naxalbari went back even before independence, shows that these questions are still there. They're still burning issues. Until they are resolved, they will keep coming up. There might be a period of calm because everybody is exhausted, but it will come up again. And each time it comes up faster. It's more furious. It's more bloody. And so by just sort of ignoring it, or as Feroz said, locking yourself up in your guarded colony and thinking your world is safe, it's not, because people can climb over fences and they can climb over walls and barbed wire, and you're not going to be safe in your bastion. So the only way to have safety and security is to have a decent life for all. And as Firu said, there have been gains. I mean, because of the pressures of left parties in the Indian Parliament, there was the institution of that minimum wage program, which isn't a big deal. I mean, it's basically keeping you from starving. But there have been certain gains, and these also have to be recognized, that there are people who have been using the parliamentary path as well. So it's a very difficult time. It's very hard to make sense of it. Some of us who've been looking at Indian history feel that maybe 3 or 4 decades earlier, things were somewhat simpler. It's becoming much more muddy. It's not as easy because, in the past, a lot of Indians were poorer. Now, particularly if you go to urban India and you don't go to village India, you think this is amazing. Like, you can get whatever you got in other parts of the world in the shopping malls of India. You can live a very enclaved life and think that the country is really progressing. But if 60 or 70% of the country's population is living in dire poverty, having to commit suicide because they can't support their families, that is a huge problem. And the country is not going to progress. It's going to come down.
Well, in terms of the natural resources that fuel this economic development, it seems that a lot of the issues around Operation Green Hunt is displacement. Displacement of indigenous peoples, rural peoples in the eastern provinces. Could you paint a bit more of a picture as to what does this displacement mean in the provinces where Manmohan Singh talks about a military campaign, Operation Green Hunt, that is addressing one of the greatest threats to India's security, as it's being called. But for the people who live there, for the Adivasi, for the tribal people, what does this displacement mean?
Well, in the area of Dantewada, about 64 villages, the majority of people have left. So a huge number of people have left, and the only people left back in the villages are older people or, lactating mothers. The majority have left. They've left because they've been afraid either reprisals from sort of indigenous militia supported and initiated by the government, like the Salwa Judam, or the possibility that Maoists are going to sort of look at them as informers. So sort of being caught in the crossfire, not knowing what to do and fleeing and living in refugee camps across borders in neighboring states where they are not wanted. And those local state governments are trying to make their lives difficult, so they would leave. So they're a very pathetic population right now of people with nowhere to go. And whatever, you know, means of survival they had is totally lost, apart from, you know, various horrors and personal massacres, you know, children who've seen their elders killed, etc. So it's quite a horrible situation.
We're talking about how many people?
I think about a lack of people is what I've heard. Yes.
Yeah.
And that's something else. You know, certain human rights activists and civil liberties activists have said that, you know, the Indian government talks about Maoists as a threat and causing violence and murdering people. But they've referred to, for example, the Gujarat genocide, where fewer people were killed and yet nobody's been brought to book. So there is sort of state complicity and a desire to demonize certain groups within society more than others. Again, it's not about necessarily taking sides or saying that one particular political group is, you know, heroic, etc. But it's to put things in context and in perspective. So if you're characterizing certain people as a threat to the state, why are other people who engage in violence against citizens not characterized in the same way?
And Fairuz, earlier in the discussion, you were talking about the gated cities, the gated communities. And I think one issue before the program, when we were talking about the idea of land in India, you know, and if we're talking about these resources and the resource-rich areas where indigenous communities are living, I think one of the central issues is how does India deal with the resources it has, the land?
Well, I mean, when they wrote the constitution in 1950, they said that all the natural resources and the forest and the river lands, it all belongs to the government of India. And I think, having said that, I think they are dealing with this question in that spirit. They're saying, okay, so far we did not need these places, these lands, to exploit the resources. Now we need it, and we understand that you are here, but we have to put you out. Now, we have seen, I mean, whenever people have been displaced in India, either because of sectarian violence or because of so-called development projects, the results have not been very good in the sense of, for example, when these people from the forest, they are driven out, where the police puts them is alongside the highways, putting them, making their little camps alongside the highways, the reason being that it's accessible to the police vans and transportation. So, I mean, it's not the choice. It's not a very planned way of moving a population from one place to the other. It's not, as I say, it's not participatory. If you think it's good for development, then people should know it's good for development. Uh-huh. And you shouldn't be just thrown out saying that I know it's good for our development, so you get the hell out of here.
Shacks on the side of the highway are pretty different than air-conditioned shopping malls.
That's correct.
Yeah, in the capital, for example.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's just about 10 minutes till 9, and we are joined on the Tuesday morning after today with Fairuz Mehdi from Alternatives International and Dolores Chu from the South Asia Center. And we're discussing Operation Green Hunt in India and having a critical discussion on the mediatized, at least in the Indian context, discussion around Operation Green Hunt. It's being covered very little in the media here in North America. Today we're hoping to bring some critical questions to listeners about Operation Green Hunt. So we don't have that much time left, but hopefully we can address a couple more points. In regards to the the specifics of what's happening right now around Operation Green Hunt, I do understand that it's hard to really get detailed information about what is happening on the ground in these eastern provinces where leftist military forces are present along with indigenous communities on one side and state forces on the other. Police forces from the Indian government are on the other side. But increasingly, there are some discussions around this issue. And so one question I had is, why is this important for people here in Canada or listeners or, let's say, progressives internationally to consider, to think about? Why should we be listening or thinking critically about Operation Green Hunt and all the questions it raises?
Well, one of the things is, like you said, you know, there's a lot of interest in India. You know, there's the kind of slumdog millionaire that you can go from rags to riches overnight. And, you know, India is this amazing success story where, you know, even as we went into a mini depression in the Western world, Indian growth rates kept rising. So it's to kind of call the question about that kind of growth and how that kind of growth is happening and who's benefiting from it. But I also think for people around the world, you know, who are interested in justice, they need to mobilize, they need to, you know, get in touch with the local Indian high commissions and voice their concern. One of the things that happens with situations in India where rights are violated is India is a constitutional democracy, and no matter how problematic it is, it functions in some way, shape or form. So there's this sense that it is an internal matter. So whether it is the Gujarat genocide or the fact that in the northeast of India, till today, you have 4 military personnel for every citizen, it is an armed camp, or in Kashmir, these are considered internal matters, but they're not, because they do spill over. India, the Indian state, needs to know that there are people around the world who are interested in what's happening. And like I said, you know, it's issues that are similar in other parts of the world. So, you know, indigenous rights, land that indigenous people live on, that is mineral resource. So people who just are aware and making these connections need to know more and inform themselves. And it is very difficult because it's so murky to sort of figure out what is going on.
And I think the interest also comes for the progressive individuals and organizations outside India because of the Nepal Maoist movement. Nepal, a decade ago, was Nepal's Maoists were underground in indigenous areas and villages. And all of a sudden, we saw their strategies changing, and then they were the ones who led the downfall of the monarchy in Nepal, and they are the largest single party in the elections after elections in Nepal. So they are very curiously, I mean, there's no comparison. For me, there's no comparison between Indian Maoists and the Nepal Maoists, but people who are observing that, they want to know what was the Maoist strategy in Nepal and was it a correct one or not for the Nepal situation. And what are these people who call themselves also Maoists? How well do we know them? So there's this inquisitiveness about do such strategies work in this part of the world?
And so in regards to the importance of trying to understand here in Canada what ideas are being raised by Naxalites, what are some of the key issues that you think should be conveyed in specific to India?
Well, I think specifically to India, it should not, as I said, the Communist Party should not be seen in the same perspective as Communist parties in Europe. Okay. They're different. And they are evolving, they are changing. There have been many splits and many change of directions. And I think these movements and these ideas should be very clearly and very carefully explored.
And just to finish the program, because we're running out of time, unfortunately, wondering, Dolores, if you have any final reflections on the importance of trying to understand or map out or come to terms with what's happening around Operation Green Hunt.
I think, again, depending on what hat one is wearing, you know, if you're a diasporic Indian and you're kind of rejoicing in the success story of India, you have to really figure out, is it a success? How do you measure success? If you are a sort of social justice activist or a progressive, wherever you are, you need to kind of inform yourself and support the people on the ground, because without this international support, it would be, you know, relatively easy for the Indian state and this international climate of neoliberalism to kind of sort of sweep this resistance aside and sort of downplay the real issues that are involved.
We've been discussing Operation Green Hunt and having a critical discussion on the current pronounced military campaign by the Indian government. The Prime Minister, Manmohan Singh, has talked about this extensively across the eastern provinces in India. There is armed forces, indigenous people that are fighting against the government's attempts to bring forward major development projects. It's been written about extensively in The Guardian by Arundhati Roy. Today on CKUT, we're hoping to bring some of these realities to listeners from the perspective of Dolores Chu, who's with the South Asia Center, and Feiruz Mehdi from Alternatives International. Thank you both for coming into studio and taking this hour. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Stefan.
Thank you, Stefan,
for having this topic.
And you've been listening to the Tuesday Morning After. I'm your host for the last hour, Stefan Christoph. We'll be back, of course, next Tuesday. I won't be here, but do tune into the program. Thank you so much to Dee Lecomte for the technical assistance in making all the things that you're hearing on your radio possible. Thank you again for listening. This is CKUT 90.3 FM, People Powered Radio in Montreal.